Content warning: pedophilia, fat phobia, and all cops being bastards.
Action, excitement,
horror, romance,
thrills and chills,
swords and sorcery,
rockets and ray guns, a dizzying panoply of the strange and impossible from the darkest depths of the human imagination. What mad universe encompasses such tales as these? Join us as we bear witness to the sweeping sprawl of all the history that never was and all the futures that could yet be. It's Adventure As You Like It on What Mad Universe.
They may be called the Palace Guard, the City Guard, or the Patrol. Whatever the name, their purpose in any work of heroic fantasy is identical. It is, round about chapter 3, or 10 minutes into the film, to rush into the room, attack the hero one at a time, and be slaughtered. No one ever asks them if they want to. This book is dedicated to those fine men. Once again, we are looking at one of Terry Pratchett's Discworld sub-series, and the series this time is possibly the most popular of the ongoing series, The Watch, starring the fine men and women of the Ankh-Morpork City Watch, led by Captain Sam Vines.
The fine men, women, and knobby knobs of the City Watch.
The show we are on is What Mad Universe. We are Adam Prosser. With me is Philip Rice.
Hello.
And we are joined once again by Discworld expert James Riley English.
Hi, I'm here too.
He is here. He will get us back on track, as we can see. So, let's get right into it. We got a lot of ground to cover. Is this the longest of the sort of sub-series of Discworld, like the one with the most books?
I think it depends on how you count the wizards.
And how you count Death series.
Oh, yeah. True.
Because the Death series. A lot of overlap.
Yeah, that's true. But there's certainly a lot that are very clearly about the Watch,
yes.
Right? Like, there's at least, what, 10?
Eight.
Eight? Oh, okay. Oh, I would have said more, but okay.
And it also
depends if you count Monstrous Regiment as a Watch one.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the nature of the Discworld is that it's crossover, obviously. Like, we're going to do the Tiffany Aching series, but we already did the Witches series, but, like, that, especially Granny Weatherwax, is a big character in the Tiffany Aching books. So, for all intents and purposes, I think we would not count those as Watch books. But,
And to add more confusion, the book The Truth, which is a standalone / Industrial Revolution one, also is kind of set up as a Watch book with just from the point of view of people who aren't the Watch.
Yeah, yeah.
In that it's literally, it has a crime goes on and the Watch are investigating it and are important characters in that, but it's just the main character is not them.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I got the impression he was kind of, like, the Watch almost morphed into the Industrial Revolution stories, and he just decided he needed a new viewpoint character for them.
Yeah.
Because they're, like, yeah, like, that seems to be how it went, more or less.
We should explain the Watch series there before we get talking about the spin-offs, which we kind of do, but
yeah.
That is the nature of Discworld, too.
Yeah, yeah, he likes an idea, and a lot of the time in Discworld, you'll see him introduce a character who seems, or a concept, or a nationality or something that seems interesting, and kind of throw it away, and then bring back another version of the same basic idea, and develop it further. The Watch, as I mentioned at the beginning, are very much an homage. Like, they're a very natural concept. Like, they don't. If you've read a lot of fantasy, you'll get it immediately. It's as I said at the beginning. It's there's always a city watch, a palace guard, a patrol, whatever in the town, and it's basically a cop procedural. Starring those characters in the fantasy world of Discworld. The leader is Sam Vimes, who is a grizzled cop who is, in the first book, he's literally about to retire, so he's a few days from retirement. Obviously, that did not take because he goes on for 8 more books. And he is Dirty Harry if he was not a jerk, I guess is how you might describe him.
He's a jerk, but he's a moral jerk.
Yeah, not a fascist then. Let's say that way.
Yes, it's kind of Antifa Dirty Harry, because Vimes really hates fascists. That's not the word used for them, but it's the sentiment that comes up, and it's sort of a joke there that Vimes is perfectly suited to being in charge of a cop because he's a policeman who hates cops.
Right. Yes.
He thinks all cops are immoral bastards who can't be trusted, including himself. Right.
There's a line where he's talking about being a recovering alcoholic, but there's no meetings to go to recover from being a cop. You can't say, "Hello, my name is Sam, and I'm a suspicious bastard."
it's sort of, as I think you put it, Ing, the fantasy of, like, what if a police officer was able to police himself properly?
These books are set in a bizarre fantasy world where cops can be good people who care about justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, Sam is actually, he's the descendant of someone who originally executed, who was it, Ing, that his ancestor executed?
Stoneface.
Stoneface. But what was Stoneface's relationship to the...
Oh, he killed the last king.
Yes, he killed the king, Lorenzo the Kind, who was a very bad king, yet everyone still gives Vimes a hard time for his ancestor being a regicide, and the sort of euphemism they use on, like, how bad Lorenzo was is just specifying occasionally people say, oh, he had good traits, like he liked children, and they said, yes, that was the problem. He really liked children.
Oof. Yeah, it's funny that that's where you can tell Terry Pratchett is British, that like dynamic is part of the story because of mocking someone for killing the king instead of American.
Yeah, implicitly, when we get into the backstory, apparently Old Stoneface had found that the king was making use of the palace torture room. So there's the various scenes are described, and that this was a very almost Hannibal-esque thing there, that it should be completely controversial to kill this king, but by virtue that he's a king, this basically marred his entire bloodline to be destitute and hated and shunned from polite society.
God, they got to Game of Thrones a couple of years early then, didn't they? Same basic idea.
Yeah, no, I was thinking that throughout, the Kingslayer thing, you know. Mm-hmm,
exactly. Different dynamic, but yeah, basically.
Yeah.
So there's Sam Vimes.
Is a better person than Jaime Lannister.
Right, and I always thought Vimes, like, maybe we can talk about this, but of course that's supposed to reflect on Vimes' relationship with Vetinari, who's the patrician of the current patrician of the city. He's the guy who you call in when authority has gotten out of control, basically. That's in his bloodline, and maybe he'll do something about it. And because, in the first book, there's literally a thing of, we might have to arrest the patrician.
And Vimes is basically, don't threaten me with a good time.
But the guy who wants to actually do it is Carrot, who is the other kind of the lead character.
Carrot
of the Watch.
is the main character of the first Watch book. Vimes is actually kind of the side protagonist of it, and Carrot being a fresh young recruit joining the recruit, fresh in from the country to the city, is our main viewpoint character.
Right, the classic, and he's riffing on cop tropes, of course. Yes. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and he becomes less and less, not to say important, but has a smaller role as the series goes on. Like, he's barely in the last 2 books.
And he's still an important character. It definitely has more there that, he becomes Vimes' sidekick more than anything.
Yeah, it does kind of feel like he won.
Because he also rises to basically to be the position directly below Vimes, so he's like next in line to be in charge of the watch and takes care of a lot of the day-to-day stuff. So they also have fun, you know, pairing him because Carrot is somebody who never gives up, like, just an almost dopey, bold-faced innocence and earnestness, no matter what happens. So, of course, pairing him up with the grizzled veteran is always funny.
Yeah. And, I mean, he was the thing about Carrot is he was raised by dwarves. He's adopted by
yes,
dwarves.
Yes, he is a 6.5-foot-tall human who insists that he is a dwarf because he culturally is dwarvish.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. I like the repeated bit in the first book where people say, you know, the new dwarf recruit, and they think, you know, they met a 6 foot tall, you know, 6 foot five man, and I think was it Colon who said devious dwarves? He must have been lying about his height.
Yes, and of course
we find out, and there's one thing finding out that Carrot is, for the lack of a better term, an anglicization of his dwarven name, which the literal translation of it is headbanger, because from an early age he was hitting his head on the ceiling.
Yeah, 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 of course, doing the Gandalf. And of course the other thing about Carrot is that we basically find out he is the... he's the survivor of the line to the throne. Like, he is the descendant of the last surviving member of the royal family and is essentially a chosen one. Like, the chosen one narrative is all around him. I believe he's got a sword that marks him out as for destiny and all this stuff. And just, he's naturally this great leader of men, and everyone, like, looks to him for heroic things.
He is treated as, like, a combination between being the settings version of Captain America in some places, and also, like, more explicitly with, like, the Destined One and, like, an almost Fisher King style is, like, the version of King Arthur.
Right.
Or he's Aragorn.
Yeah, or,
you know,
or
raised
Aragorn,
by elves,
yes.
But dwarves instead of elves, yeah. But yeah.
Right. And they, and I mean, the thing very, very strongly that Pratchett does right from the beginning is they, like, shut down the fact that, like, oh, he's clearly the chosen one who's meant to assume the throne, and he's not going to do that. It's not going to happen. But partly just by, like, nobody puts the pieces together at first, but also, but by eventually everyone basically knows that he's the heir to the throne.
It becomes an open secret to those in high society and to the rest of society, a persistent rumor, and it's just that Carrot basically refuses to quit his job to become king. There's occasionally some inferences there that, you know, due to the potential mystic nature of kingship, since it is a fantasy series, he technically still is the king, and that comes with possibly some supernatural abilities even without that. Like, it is said there that he has the unnerving ability to kind of shame people if not being good, at least ashamed of their bad behavior.
Yeah, and there's a bit in Jingo where they sort of go into, like, an Arab style country, and there's war breaking out and they're trying to make peace, and he, like, just sort of stares down, like, the equivalent of, like, the Bedouins, and just convinces them to fight along his side. And
he's very much also the legendary hero set there. Like, if there is a need to face down a dragon or a, like, rampaging horde there, that is effectively Carrot's cosmic role for the city. And
Lisan El Gaib.
Yeah, and kind of everyone's agreed that Carrot seems to genuinely agree with the values of, like, the pseudo-republic/democracy the city's gone into. So he won't, of course, take the throne, because, you know, that wouldn't be proper, but he's acting as a necessary placeholder.
Yeah, what I was saying was, even after he did all that, he still mentioned he had a commander, and that causes one of the villains to sort of just give up, because, like, this guy has a commander?
Yeah, exactly. The thing you really see with the Watch, almost more than any of the other Discworld books, maybe a bit in the Industrial Revolution, in the Moist von Lipwig books, but it is very much these sort of tensions between, like, the old-fashioned ideals that are extemporized in fantasy and the, like, what we know is correct in a way that clashes with the fantasy. So we know that the Chosen One, and even to an extent monarchy, I don't know Pratchett's exact views on that.
Very negative.
Yeah. Well, he had negative views on everything. I mean, he didn't seem to have a huge opinion of democracy either, or revolutions or anything. Like, there's a lot of wisecracks about revolutions in Night Watch, and other places as well. There's a general level of political cynicism to everything. But it is definitely, as you say, it's like a cop who could actually, you know, do the things that, like, police the police.
Yeah.
And a king who does the right thing, who's so noble, who's so into doing the right thing as king that he won't become king.
Yeah.
Right?
There's a line there, because in one of them there's basically a conspiracy to shuffle Carrot to the side and put in a suitable replacement for king that the nobles think they could easily manipulate and treat as a puppet, and kind of Vimes points out, it's like, oh yeah, everyone was so excited when it's like, oh good, the king's returned, and then he'll bring about peace and prosperity and justice, and then you all discovered, oops, he actually believes all that stuff about peace and prosperity and justice. We better get rid of this guy.
Yeah, exactly. I always love that kind of tension in a story like that, where it's like the person's too good at their ideals for a corrupt system that just wanted everyone to pretend the ideals were right.
Yeah, and as you said, like, the Discworld books have a very cynicism about everything and take some shots about everything, but the sort of joke is that both Carrot and Vimes are the genuine, uncynical idealist take on that, and that's also why they clash with society, but also, you know, that clashing is going to be what makes someone a heroic figure.
Right. For
both embodying the stated values of society and clashing with the reality of it.
Exactly. As you say, he is the Captain America of that world.
To the point, literally, that in the Hogfather, which is the Christmas story for Discworld, it's not a Watch book, but they do have to mention that a popular toy is the Captain Carrot one-man watch, which is described that they basically made an action figure of him.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, before we move on from Carrot, an important dwarf thing that I think is introduced in these books. It's developed as it goes on, but the idea that dwarves only have one gender.
There is only one gender, and it is dwarf.
Except they sort of do, as we eventually see.
Yeah, except that has the problem that as dwarves start living with humans and noticing, you know, that there's two kinds of humans, that there are some dwarves that realize, oh, you know, I do feel more inclined to presenting feminine, which is not traditionally dwarfish, and thus is a huge taboo, not to be female, but to admit it and to be openly and flagrantly female.
Yeah, it says that traditional dwarf courtship is just trying very hard
suddenly
to
find out
figure
what the
out
other sex
what the other
is,
person's sex is with
it.
Yeah,
the dwarf like culture and manners have that it is impolite to ask or even talk about such things.
Yeah. I like that. You know, what's great about that is that literally comes from J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah.
Because Tolkien has a bit where he talks about how, like, because people sort of, I can't remember if it's in one of the appendices or anything, but of course it became like, well, there don't seem to be any female dwarves in Tolkien as we would understand it. And then he mentioned somewhere that, well, the thing is, people just can't tell the male dwarves from the female dwarves, which obviously led to things like, okay, so the female dwarves must have beards, and all these other things, and this is Terry Pratchett taking that and running with it, of course. Yeah. And of course, they showed out to it explicitly in the movies, which is not, there's no line like that in the actual book Lord of the Rings. It's something
that became this thing in the appendixes and in a footnote there that,
And then when they show female dwarves in The Hobbit, they just have, like, little straggly beards. But so do a lot of the male dwarves in those
movies.
That
was pretty cowardly, though. I mean,
That was cowardly. The Discworld goes with the whole thing that all dwarves are supposed to look like dwarves with big bushy beards and being clad in either armor or leather there, to the point that if a dwarf, male or female, cannot grow a beard, it's basically considered that they're supposed to wear a facial wig.
Right.
And they have a traditional battle axe that they're allowed to, you know, take even, like, to meet, like, a leader, like a king or whatever, because, like, that just, it's like the Sikh's knife sort of thing.
It's considered cultural. It's like, of course, but they're not going to use it on anyone, you know, they just want to carry it around, so it's clear that if something happens, they could use it on anyone. It's an important part of their culture.
And one of the Watch regulars who first appears in the third book,
Ciri is very fun. She is introduced as a main character in Feet of Clay, which actually directly through her addresses the dwarf gender issue, because Ciri is a lady dwarf and one that kind of realizes that she wants to openly be female in defiance to tradition, and this marks her as sort of unintentionally starting the dwarf feminist movement in the city and the rest of the disc, and becoming a figure of international praise and revilement, depending on how people stand on the issue.
And of course, it becomes kind of an LGBT thing.
Yes,
this is also kind of why it got so ridiculous. Remember the brief period when people were trying to retroactively claim Terry Pratchett as a TERF?
Yeah.
And people pointed out all the dwarf stuff as just completely countermanding that.
It's not just dwarf stuff. There's other stuff that are written with both dwarf and non-dwarf, like, basically queer or trans characters in it.
Right. I mean,
Yeah, and also we...
Yeah, and also the things
family
that he's said
and
done.
And, like,
no, of course. I mean, yeah, no.
Yeah.
It was so blatantly in the book. I mean, if you wanted to be really literal, it's the thing where you could say, no, see, he agreed they needed to be gendered. But, like, it's pretty obvious what it's actually about, right? Like, it's very straightforwardly about, you know, arguably trans, arguably non-binary, and as you say, arguably feminism. It doesn't map perfectly onto anything, but it's about gender issues, basically.
I like the runner in Feet of Clay where Ciri just experimenting with, like, you know, Vimes will say, Sergeant Little, or Constable Littlebottom, are you wearing makeup? Yes, sir. Okay. Like, not being out
it's
as
almost
a woman
comedic
yet,
that it takes so
just,
long for Vimes to realize what's going on, just with the new constable increasingly presenting feminine there. But also, he has more important things to do than question what this workplace comedy / drama is going on.
And she still keeps her beard. Somebody asks her if she's going to shave her beard.
It's like, no, that's absolutely scandalous because, you know, it's like, yeah, being a female dwarf is something, but not having a beard would be undwarvish.
And there's a bit in one of the later books where she's wants to go to a fancy ball, and she doesn't really know how to dress yet because she's still sort of new at being outwardly female. And, she puts glitter on her battle axe and stuff.
And to be fair to her, no one knows at that point what female for a dwarf means. So she's really goes with, like, a trans experience, that she's really, you know, coming up with what female presenting means to her on the fly and just going with it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great example of how, like, that really is how fantasy can deal with issues like this in ways that, and like, it wasn't, at the time, it wasn't hugely controversial. People just accepted it as part of the comedy and part of the fantasy, yeah. You know? I think actually that's a good transition as well into the other major, there's numerous non-human members of the team, but the other major one is Sergeant Detritus, who is a troll.
Yeah, Sergeant Detritus.
Detritus, excuse me. Yeah. Because all the trolls have names that reflect rocks in some
right,
way or
Discworld, trolls are silicon, are basically a silicon-based version of humans. And mm-hmm. they're larger in scale. They're actually, like, troll-shaped, but they're made out of, like, silicon, so rocky material, and they have to eat calcium and minerals to survive and, like, drink mud. And because their brains are silicon-based like computers, they're smarter at low temperatures. So up mm-hmm. in the polar mountain... Or, sorry, not... There's no poles there, but the... Axis hub snow caps, trolls are very smart and have their whole cities, but when they come down to the valleys and that where it's a lot warmer, they literally get slower of thinking.
Right, yeah, they get stupider. And there's a scene in one of the books where Detritus gets he gets locked in like a meat locker, I think, and he starts becoming super genius and writing equations.
He literally
on the wall.
Goes galaxy brain, and because the freezer is cold enough is actually cold enough to actually kill a dwarf through hypothermia, he tries in his last moments of consciousness to write the theory of everything in physics. And succeeds in doing it, what unifies all the forces of physics and magic and the gods and the meaning of everything. And he, you know, just writes it in the frost there. And when the people rescue him, they just don't know what it is and just wipe it away.
Yeah. And he forgets because he's too stupid.
This was
at that point,
this was
right?
a magical meat locker because pork futures are... It's like this whole weird quantum thing where, like, it's meat that, exists in a quantum flux state.
Because people started buying and investing in future porks, there's, like, a weird... Somebody built a warehouse to store these hypothetical pork products. And due to the nature of, like, the magic in the area, it's now, like, literal. You can see the pork exists in... the warehouse, but as the pig that it will, but as like the pig that it currently is approaches the time when it's going to be butchered, they get less tangible and more insubstantial as the pork goes from being hypothetical to real.
Trolls, so it's a big, the dwarves and the trolls are mortal nemeses throughout all of history.
Yeah, as
explained, which is a big...
because dwarves have a strong cultural inclination to break open interesting-looking rocks to harvest valuable minerals inside, and trolls are interesting-looking rocks with valuable minerals inside.
Yeah, exactly. So they fight constantly underground, and so having a dwarf and a troll on the watch, who are friends, basically, they become, you know, they're buddy cop pals, as it were. Again, this is, you know...
Detritus, when he's introduced, actually has a first buddy cop with the other first dwarf Constable Cuddy, who at first they're really racist to each other and bicker constantly and then become fast friends, including Cuddy making Detritus a clockwork helmet that has a cooling fan in it to help with his brain problem. But Cuddy is killed in the first book that he's in there, so...
Right. I forgot about that. But then Cheery kind of takes over as
Yeah,
Cheery
comes up as
the
main dwarf afterwards.
Right. But of course, again, it's cop... The first book especially, doing all the cop show riffs.
Yeah.
And then the other two big characters are Sergeant Colon and Nobby.
But we also...
Colon is...
We also have Sergeant Angua, who is also the other non-human main character, and she is brought in as a diversity higher in the book that she's in, and everyone assumes that the patrician, the ruler of the city, had her hired, you know, under the thing, oh, to have a woman in the watch. Actually, it's because she's a werewolf and is the representative as the first undead member of the watch.
So werewolves are considered undead?
That's a joke there, that it's like they have a lot of traits of...
Yeah, there's a discussion of that.
Living
that
creatures, but also a lot of creatures of the undead, but the scholars seem to say that if you shoot them in the head with an arrow, they don't stay down. That makes them undead to me.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Yeah, I don't remember that bit as well, but as well as I could. But yeah, it's... Yeah, she becomes Carrot's love interest,
yes.
Basically, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Very quick.
And that is actually the impetus for the crime in the third book, where the it turns out the ultimate perpetrator is a vampire who is genealogist for, like, the rich people in town. And it turns out that he's actually doing that as, like, human
right.
husbandry. Breeding the best rich people so that
yeah.
he can later, you know, eventually drink their blood. And he sees that the king is, you know, coming back. So and the king is romantically involved with a werewolf,
which is unacceptable.
And, like, you know, the king's which is unacceptable because he doesn't want to drink werewolf blood because vampires
right.
and werewolves don't like each other. So he sets off a whole murder plot to, and actually an attempt to install Nobby
oh,
as the king.
We should go over who Nobby Dobbs and Fred Colin
yeah.
are then.
So Fred Colin yeah. is like he is the classic Hammer horror movie cop who would say, what, they make a joke about him saying, what's all this then, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he does say that at some point. and yeah, he's the dim-witted...
He has big medieval Paul Blart energy.
Yeah, it says at the beginning there's somebody like him in every police force, and he never rises above sergeant. And,
right.
Yeah. He's basically like the British gammon stereotype.
Yeah, and they talk
like a
yeah, at
big
first
red-faced
glance,
guy.
You would see nothing
he's,
more
he's
than
kind
a
of...
particularly fat and stupid copper. And to be fair, that is pretty much what he is.
They talked about how he's married and has kids, and he's like, his wife works during the day, he works during the night, and their entire relationship was based on passing notes to each other. They had three kids, which must have been some very persuasive handwriting.
Yes. There's
and,
a whole book where he's prepared to retire and literally move to the country and buy a farm. So he's due to buy the farm, and it constantly is teasing the retiree trope because he's constantly almost killed in that book until he calls off the retirement, seemingly having noticed the pattern.
Nice. Mendoza! It's interesting because...
And he's bigoted too, but like in a... Like,
he's the dumb conservative relative way he gets told off
yeah.
a lot. He's...
Yeah,
he's the relic.
He's the relic, mostly harmless, and he was Vimes' superior when Vimes joined the Watch, and Vimes pretty much keeps him around out of a familial loyalty.
Doesn't the Watch literally consist of, when it starts,
yes.
it's like just Vimes, Carrot, Colin, and Nobby, and that's the entire Watch,
yes.
if I'm not mistaken?
Yes, there is
yeah.
very much in the first book that we
yeah.
are the City Watch. The entire City Watch.
yeah.
But
and
yeah, even as it grows, Vimes kind of realizes that he can't have somebody so blatantly, like, incompetent in any position of authority, so he pretty much makes ceremonial jobs or roles for him to do, mostly morale-based or administrative, which is fine by him because that means he doesn't have to go out too often to the streets where he might get hurt.
Yeah. He's the guy behind the desk rider. It is funny that
there's also the joke that the one thing he excels at is being the jailer, because he always keeps the jail keys either on a chain looped to his belt or in the furthest back to the at the furthest back of the lowest drawer of his desk, which he always locks before leaving, and saying the fact that that of all things, he's extremely competent about prisoner security, and that standard makes him unique amongst jailers in all of fantasy.
Exactly, right.
Oh, one more thing about Colin. He takes over the job as commander of the watch, or the captain of the watch, briefly in one book, and instantly goes mad with
power. Not even really
power.
He goes insane from paranoia. And
right.
Starts abusing power because he becomes convinced that employees are stealing the sugar cubes from the break room. And this winds up taking precedent over everything else, with him just obsessively watching the sugar cubes at one point.
Yes.
And then when the whole watch strikes and quits, basically, and Carrot comes back at the end and finds out what happened, and Carrot said, "Well, we all know who's to blame for this. I am. For leaving you without any other options."
Exactly. Leadership. Yes. And I mean, it actually is funny. Do they ever have the chief chewing somebody, slamming their fist on the desk and saying you're off the case kind of cliche at any point in these?
They do, but it's done by Vetinari typically doing that to Vimes. And they also lampshade that with every time Vetinari does it, he admits that he's doing it because he knows that it's going to wind up Vimes into investigating the case even harder.
Specifically, it says
that every time he does it, Vimes leaves and punches the same spot in the wall when he on his way out, to the point that there's like a very comforting groove right there. And the one time where Vimes leaves without punching the wall, Vetinari kind of has a minute of panic, realizing that he actually pushed him too far, that he is actually going to drop the case.
And I mention it because it is kind of funny that Pratchett, I guess these tropes got over into Britain, but he seems to be using a lot of American cop tropes more than anything. I guess
there's British cop shows. They do similar stuff.
I guess I feel like some of these are very specifically American, but again, maybe
it has to be in British, because where else does the "what's all this" then come from?
Oh yeah, of course. No, that is definitely there, and there's definitely some things that are noticeably British. It's just the sort of rogue cop on the, like, Sam Vimes has a certain Americanness to it. Like, he's Dirty Harry, right?
There's those characters in British TV too, like what's his face on Life on Mars.
Well, yeah, like that's a fairly recent thing though. I like that.
Yeah, but it's riffing on stuff like the Sweeney and then what was it, the Nick?
Okay.
I don't know. There's lots of British shows.
I'm actually reading a book right now called I Am the Law, which is about the history of Judge Dredd and the parallel with British policing. And it does actually make the argument that, like, that kind of figure wasn't very common on British television until, and even in as much as it did start, or in British movies until a bit later. Of course, Judge Dredd is explicitly an American character, even though he's a British creation, right? Like, they did it because that's the British idea of what an American cop is. So I guess that's where it's coming from more than anything. And of course, yeah, as you say, I mean, yes, by the 80s, they did have British cop shows that were like that. But it's very much feeding in from the American idiom, I think, more than the British one. So, but I guess it's true that, like...
Oh, I'm sorry, the Nick is an American hospital show. I don't know why I thought that was a British crime show.
I don't know.
Sorry,
the Nick. I don't know.
The other main character is Fred Colin's sidekick, which is Nobby Nobbs. And he is described as, he's like the perpetual kind of harmless but disreputable cop. Like, it's the... almost like the idea that, taking the joke that cops and criminals have the same profile, and Nobby, like, easily could have been a very good criminal, and is like, and like suffers from casual kleptomania, and thus, like, rightfully should be a pickpocket, but he fell into the wrong crowd and is a cop.
And he's the ugliest man on on the Discworld.
Yes, he is so ugly that he is forced by government decree to carry to carry around a letter certified from the midwife that did his delivery that he is in fact a human and should be treated as a human.
And he was kicked out of the human race for shoving.
Yes,
and
it says that his friend, amongst his friends, they highly suspect the letter is a forgery.
And like, we didn't actually bring this up in the last Discworld one, but the character Agnes Nitt, who is a fun character, but I felt like the fat jokes sometimes got a little mean spirited. With Nobby, they're mean spirited, but in a way that doesn't reflect any reality, because nobody is as ugly as Nobby.
I feel that Agnes gets enough of the gets like enough to her credit that there's some consolation.
Yeah, like I said,
there.
she's a fine character. Just some of the like the narration does some fat jokes that you know, but with Nobby, the jokes like because they don't apply to any real person, so.
And the other thing about Nobby is, as you say, he's harmless because his ambitions are just so low. I mean, he's a thoroughly vile person, but he just can't be bothered.
Well,
like it's almost like the vileness counteracts
that,
it.
As that they say that, like every time they have to admit that if you can look past everything else about Nobby, he's not that bad a guy. He might even be described decent under the right light. Of course, it would have to be a very low light, but
or that,
it has the thing of Angua real, like mentioning that part of the problem with Nobby is that like there's everything Nobby about him, but deep down he has a very romantic soul. The trouble, his problem is that his soul is attached to his body.
One of the bits I liked was I can't remember what the context was exactly, but Karen Vimes talking about who did a crime, and Vimes saying, you know, the perpetrator is the most devious creature you can imagine, and Carrot says, "You don't mean, yes I do, but Nobby was with us the whole time."
Exactly.
No, there is so more than one occasion where they just say, this crime would take a particularly twisted mind verging on the insane. Incidentally, Nobby, you didn't do it, did you? Not that I can recall, sir.
But also on his ugliness, like there's, like when they're about to go to war with Klatch, the sort of Arabic neighbor, Arabic style neighbor, and Colin's like, they have a different skin color than we do. Well, different skin color than I do, because Nobby doesn't, like, his skin is all patchy and it doesn't match anybody else's.
Nobby's skin is many colors, none of which seem to naturally occur amongst any human ethnicity.
He's the one-man iteration of all humans are inferior to more, equally inferior to Morbo!
Yes, pretty much.
And also, another bit from that book was when Nobby has to disguise himself as a belly dancer. And the narration says, now, it's basically a law of narrative that when the ugly man disguises himself as a woman, someone will find him outrageously attractive and fall in love with him. But with Nobby, he's really, you know, like, nature can only go so
it's
far.
It's like, in this case, Nobby pushes it so far, not even the narrative can bend
right
to make that happen.
Okay, we should talk about Vetinari.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Vetinari, I think, is a character I really like that I think Adam doesn't.
Well, it's not that I don't like him. He is. I've come around a little bit on what Pratchett was doing. I feel a little maybe uncomfortable. Maybe I'm too sincere a person. But in terms of what Vetinari represents, I always feel a little bit like that's his. In some ways, that's Pratchett's cynicism getting a little too amped up for me. But I have come like he's certainly an interesting character. Like he's a great character. No getting around that.
So let's talk about what he is.
Yeah, he's the patrician of Ankh-Morpork, so he's essentially the most powerful man in the Discworld, wouldn't you say? Like, more or less.
Yes, but at least politically, and he is technically the despotic tyrant of it on paper, though the way that he manages the city and, like, because kind of a big thing seems to be that he is genuinely basically a policy and a poli-science wonk. So he he kind of like as much for like pride and hobby gets the city running as well as possible, and that of course has, you know, a bit of the paradox that means that, you know, one person shouldn't have all the power because that's a load-bearing issue. So he's kind of he's kind of unofficially made the role of tyrant ceremonial and acted as if there's constitutional limits, though he will remind people that at any point he can just invoke the right of because I say so.
Yeah, I think as I recall them saying, it's like Ankh Morpork, veterinary ran Ankh Morpork very thoroughly on the principle of one man, one vote. He was the man, he had the vote, right? And but yeah, you know what I've thought about it since, and yeah, like I say, it's that sort of, in a sense, I kind of feel like this idea of, well, if you could just find, it's done through a cynical and humorous way, but it does feel like it gets into the idea of like, well, if you could just find the right smart guy to run everything, things would run. And I mean, it's not that things are perfectly run in Ankh Morpork, of course, but like, he's the most competent character in the Discworld books, essentially. Except maybe for Vimes himself, yeah, as well.
Between Vimes, Vimes' wife, and I think Death himself, Death and Death's immediately family themselves may be the most
honestly, I don't even know if death counts. Death's constantly getting it. Death is getting into problems Death should
now,
not be getting into.
Okay, one thing that I wanted to
say,
apparently the idea of Vetinari is the idea of like the somebody who has, if the position of evil ruler of the city was like official, so like everything about them had to scream like the evil tyrant of the city, but that's just what the title is there. He has all the tropes of it, like specifically all the tropes of a Bond villain, and then the joke there, but what if actually he was a genuinely dedicated civil servant? He's a very sinning and apparently politically competent and cunning person, and said that his big success is finding ways to incentivize people to govern themselves, or put various powers at odds with each other so that they sort of check and balance themselves.
So we should get into the guild system.
Yeah, where I was getting, like, he's given a lot of power to the guild systems, which are the trade guilds, which kind of de facto run much of the city, and he's given them a lot of power and privilege so that they've been able to get very wealthy under his command, and he's just, like, you know, reminding them that, you know, they are indebted to him about that, and, you know, by virtue that, like, especially things like the Thieves Guild or the Assassins Guild, that, you know, since they're official members of the community now, the government knows their names and their families' addresses. Just saying.
Yeah.
Right. It's with great power comes great responsibility, and that means you have to stop being a criminal, kind of, in some ways.
Yeah,
anyway.
The fact that under some circumstances theft is legal in the city is a joke, but Terry Pratchett also put thought into how it would work. Mm-hmm. And it sort of like as it was explained in the A Tourist's Guide to Ankh Morpork, which is a in-universe document that was released, basically the Thieves Guild wound up being tricked into becoming the Revenue Service, because by their founding statute, they can't rob anybody blind. They have to rob a percentage based on income. And for particularly valuable items, people they give receipts when they steal valuable items, and then you can go to the Thieves Guild and basically buy it back. like a property tax, and then, you know, by virtue that it's a guild with a big, you know, official building, that makes it easy to tax. So Vetinari has basically said it would be very difficult to have everybody to go around collecting taxes from everyone, but thieves already go around collecting money from everyone, so we just have the thieves do it for us and then take the government's cut from there.
And also like, they're the only ones allowed to do thieving, and so if somebody is an unlicensed thief, then the Thieves Guild will just
That's
go down
illegal.
Upon them like, you know, hell.
Yeah.
Yes, if you do unlicensed...
Call the cops.
If you do unlicensed theft, you better hope the guard... city guard catches you, because they'll just throw you in prison.
Exactly.
The Beggars Guild, like, the leaders are in, like, a higher tax bracket, so they have to beg for more stuff, so they, like, have to beg for a full banquet and, a few mansions. You don't happen to have a few mansions lying around, do you?
And there's also the joke that there's the beggars that are so destitute they were thrown out of the guild. And are illegal beggars. The Assassin's Guild, which in a roundabout way winds up running the private schools for the elite of the city, like for all the nobles send their children to be trained as assassins because it's the best education, and then they just withdraw before the final exam where they have to actually kill someone.
Right. And I mean, and, that's veterinary as
yes,
well.
Yes, veterinary is an accomplished assassin.
He came out of the guild in the backstory. There's a time travel one where Vimes goes back to his youth and sort of replaces his... It's like basically that Star Trek episode, Past Tense, but in Discworld.
Yeah. Oh, right, he replaces himself, yeah, in the past, yeah. But veterinary is it's kind of a joke on the fact that like the Shakespearean regals are always plotting to assassinate each other anyway, so you just go to assassin school.
Yeah, and now and by making the assassins legal, there's none of that messy shooting or stabbing each other in the street because official assassins have to have rules.
Yeah, right. And there's in the second book, a gun gets invented, like a. It's called the Gone, but
because it makes you gone.
Yeah, but the assassins are actually very much against that because that could mean anybody could kill anybody. It's not like this specialized.
If anybody could kill anyone, why that would be chaos. Yeah.
They don't tend to use swords. They like prefer weapons that can be like hidden among the bodies, so knives and stilettos and stuff, poisons, you know.
There's a joke that the assassins insist that actually they are a very humanist organization because they know the value of human life down to the penny.
And the standalone novel Pyramids, the hero of that is like he's a graduate of the Assassin's Guild as well, because he's a royalty because he is literally the heir to the Pharaonic dynasty. He's a pharaoh of pseudo Egypt in I forget what the country is called in the Discworld, but it's that, and it deals with riffing on Egyptian history and mythology, but he's also an assassin, which becomes a plot point. I won't spoil it for
yeah
Bill,
I haven't read that one
read
yet
Pyramids, but yeah but and anyway, so with all these systems, this is where it leads into the Industrial Revolution stuff, so that's actually something we could continue talking about that when we get to the Industrial Revolution and the Moise von Lipsweg story, but you can see how he was thinking about all this stuff.
Yeah, I haven't read any of those yet, but I know the Clack system is dealt with in the later Watch books and stuff, so I know, like, of it, basically, but I haven't actually read any of those books
yet. Yeah, the Clack systems is a semaphore system that has pretty much the setting gets more developed. They start to develop, basically, mathematical coding in that, which lets them make, basically, an internet using semaphore towers.
Right, yeah. It's an interesting idea, but
and
we should
also
that save
it,
that for...
Yeah, and just quickly also that is pointing out that this is an idea that works a lot better in a flat world because you don't have to worry about the curvature of the Earth ruining your line of sight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and yeah, there's a lot of ideas about like how technology and society would work, and that all like builds up and then starts to spill over into the Industrial Revolution books, which are more explicitly about that exact stuff. So we can leave off and go to that that for a later series.
One thing I find interesting about Vetinari as a character, in one of the side books, he like actually gets drunk and seems to like express his genuine political opinions, which are oddly actually kind of like he Like, his natural political leaning seems to be anarchist, which is very funny for someone who's officially a tyrant, but
yeah,
it kind of does make sense when, you know, as you say, looking at his backstory that we see in the time travel episode and actually how he's governed to basically limit the amount of power any one institution, including his, has. It kind of does track as, like, a consistent belief.
Well, I mean, any authoritarian leader is an anarchist for themselves.
Well, yes.
I have no rulers for myself. But yeah, I mean, it makes me think of a Claudius in I, Claudius, yeah, specifically, but maybe in real history as well, because he was a Republican. He wanted, in the sense that he wanted to bring back the Roman Republic, and then he ended up getting swept onto the throne by the what are they called, the Roman Guard, the Praetorian Guard,
yeah,
because they needed an emperor.
Yeah, by virtue Caligula, that he was basically the only person even close to lined up succession left standing after Caligula.
Right, yeah, he killed everyone.
Like in the,
so like we,
in the I, Claudius show, they literally portray it that he was literally the nearest one to the guard because he was hiding behind the curtains.
Right, yeah. They just they needed an heir quickly because the Praetorian, and it was only because they didn't want to go back to, like, serving on the frontier. They wanted to keep their cushy job in Rome, and they swept him into power. And then so when Claudius was in power, he was like, well, maybe I can make this a better empire that I'm the brutal head of, right? Which, of course, does not work. You know, that's why, I mean, realistically, that's how I think something like Venator,
yeah,
would shake out. Because, you know, you can't give someone absolute power and expect them to use it,
yes,
properly,
and,
but yeah.
And to be fair, for, like, Vetinari is very smart, very competent. He also gets basically face faulted and the crap kicked it out of him more than any other character.
Like, really? You think Vetinari does?
Of any of the regular characters, because remember, in the second Watch book, he gets permanently maimed. He does in many books get, like, let's say another of the Watch books, he spends all of it basically on his deathbed from an assassination poisoning attempt.
In the first book, he's in
that, the
dungeon for a lot of it, and
yep,
has to get the rats to, like, he trains the rats to do all the work for him and spy on people outside of the dungeon.
Another one, he is knocked unconscious by a coup attempt to replace him with a double. And, you know, as it said that on two occasions, Vimes has had to arrest him, though he's beaten the charges every time on the technicality of being innocent.
Yeah, it is, you know, Pratchett is not, okay, that, I mean, that's fair enough. I guess he just, he has a natural dignity that a lot,
yes,
of Discworld characters don't have, I guess.
He very much has the dignity, and, like, it's almost expressed that pretty much his success is of pulling that off, and, like, he's described as very cat-like, so I feel like that Pratchett, who loves cats, definitely felt the need to get a cat character to have the moments, like, when a cat fails to properly jump, and then just has to, you know, just resume their behavior and just blatantly is hoping no one will call them on it.
I think Sybil's an important enough character. She's
yes,
she's a rich lady who he meets in the first book because she trains swamp dragons, and the first book is about the return of the last true dragon to the Discworld. And she's an older lady. Like, she's not ancient, but, you know, she's a middle-aged lady. She's very tall. She's big. It's repeatedly talked about that. As a big lady, she sort of tries to not take up space, which is an interesting character beat. She's very accommodating to other people and just an extremely nice person. It's a running gag that everybody she went to school with, which seems to be every important woman on the disc, she keeps in touch with she writes letters to every year, and actually she seems to write letters to everybody she's ever met in any capacity.
Yeah, and it is mentioned, I think, at one point, even by Vetinari, that she is, like, if she wanted to, is potentially his biggest political threat.
Yeah. And
fortunate, as Vimes also says, that his wife has the baffling belief that certain people he has to deal with, who he is convinced should not be trusted, his wife seems to think that they are absolutely fine chaps, most notably Nobby and Vetinari, who she appears to be genuinely good friends with outside of her husband's interactions with him. Including being on a first-name basis.
Yeah, Havelock.
Much to Vimes' annoyance.
Yeah, Vetinari's first name is Havelock.
Yeah.
Is that revealed early or in the Nightwatch book?
I think later. I don't remember. Oh, I probably should point out the pun of Vetinari's name is a pun on the Medici family that, you know, for portions of times, ruled Venice. Medici means doctor. Vetinari means veterinary.
I didn't know. Yeah, okay. Nice. That's fun.
Yeah. And and also the thing of, like, saying that he's, like, has the aesthetics of a Bond villain, but to reflect that, you know, he's not evil. Instead of menacingly stroking a cat, he tries to do the same effect with his pet dog. It does not work.
Yeah, so we should probably wrap up. Do you have any final thoughts, Ing, on all this?
Probably a ton of stuff. I could talk a lot on it. There's yeah. even more characters of just, like, side characters in the Watch that are genuinely very fun. Like, we could talk about the other constables that show up. Like, there's the gnomes, Buggy Squire and Wee Mad Arthur,
yeah.
That
yes.
are look into what the Discworld gnomes are, which tend to be, like, very. The gnomes are 6 foot tall. Six inch tall humanoids. And as I said, they're a growing economic power in the city because they make the same wages, but. And pay the same amount for food, but for a gnome, a loaf of bread is meals for an entire week, and if they're cunning about it, also lodging.
Yeah, and yeah. They tie into the Tiffany Aching books as
yes.
well, kind of. But, yeah.
There's...
And the stuff with the golems.
Oh,
yes!
Oh, God. Well. Yeah, yeah, Dorful is a golem who becomes free, and Dorful at the end announces that he's an atheist, but he's willing to hear any reasonable arguments about the existence of gods. And then he gets struck by lightning, and he looks up and says, "You call that an argument?" And they pointed out the disc finally has a fireproof atheist.
Yeah, the gods had met their match, an insulated
yes.
atheist.
he gets along with Constable Visit, what's Visit's full name?
Constable Visit the Unbelievers with explanatory pamphlets.
Yes, he's an Omnian, which was a, like the parody of Christianity, basically, like a monotheistic religion on the disc. And I have actually read Small Gods, so that's sort of the backstory there, but...
Yes, the Omnians used to be a tyrannical religion that would, like, burn heretics for claiming that the world was flat instead of round. They've recovered, and now they believe that the proper way to have a crusade against unbelievers is to go door to door with pamphlets and try to convince people to join.
And he gets
yeah,
along
right.
with Dorful, because Dorful is actually asking for more pamphlets so he can have stuff to argue against.
It's the first time it's happened.
Yeah, it's some good stuff. Yeah, I like that, because the Small Gods has the Omnians reforming from a very blood and thunder militant religion.
Yeah,
to,
specifically
like, a
because
more kinder,
they're
yeah.
the joke about that Small Gods is about a Old Testament slash like almost like Greek mythology style blood sacrifice god finding religion.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that whatever we slot that in, but yeah,
that's what. That is legit one of my favorites.
Yeah, Small Gods is great.
Yeah, Small Gods is possibly his best one, I would almost say. It's way up there, at least.
Yeah, and it's a standalone, so people can read it at any time.
Oh, there's also a zombie, Reg.
Reg Shu, who is a political activist and has been since before he died. He basically was a communist before, and he died nobly in the revolution against a previous non-veterinary, genuinely tyrannical leader. And he's continued his activism since his resurrection, which it's not... Nobody, even in the context of Discworld, is sure exactly why some people come back as zombies, but they believe a big part of it is that they're too stubborn to die. So Reg Shu, who was like a political idealist and radical, is simply believed that basically his soul cannot rest until he actually achieves full equitable communism. So he's going to be around for a while, and his current big cause there is trying to promote equal rights for the dead, not just the undead, because he is convinced that anybody could be a zombie. All the corpses in the ground just aren't properly motivated. So he goes down to the graveyard on his days off and tries to give more inspiring speeches to the corpses to get them to get up.
There's also an accountant who joins the watch. Anyway, sorry, we could go on forever.
Like I said, very good about getting a ton of really fun characters.
And they recur, too. Like, they'll show up a couple times in future watch books. It's very good.
I think we mentioned the Igors in the Witches book, and Igor joins as the medic and forensic scientist. He's a rebellious Igor because he kind of has an emo haircut and refuses to speak in a lisp.
And there's a running bit where they tell him not to bring back the dead with electricity. Anyway.
Yes, but please don't bring back the recently dead dwarves with electricity. It's against their religion.
Okay. Yeah.
There's a lot there. Anyway.
Yes.
Let's wrap it up. Damn it, we're loose cannons and we're off the case. We've been Adam Prosser and Philip Rice, and we're handing in our badge and our gun. We were joined by James Ng English, who may break every rule in the book, but damn it, he gets results. We're all in Dutch with the chief, Alex Ross, our host and producer, who has to explain all this to the commissioner. Oh, and just one more thing. Our theme song was sung by Jack Catch-Him-In-The-Act Feerick, who is just 3 days away from retirement. Just a reminder, we both have a Patreon, which helps pay hosting costs and whatnot, so defund the police and fund our podcast. If you subscribe to either of us, you can listen to this podcast early every time, as well as getting bonus material, cut footage and illustrations and comics, and access to the police radio channel, among other things. Just go to Patreon and search for Philip Rice, 1L, or Adam Prosser, 2 S's, or what-mad-universe.pinecast.co for the links. You can also follow us on Blue Sky at whatmaduniverse, or Prankster36 for me, or Spear Halfock with an F for Philip.
Do you have anything to promoting?
Oh, I'll promote whatisbrandecho.com, the webcomic I work. Sadly, going a little slow, but I'm very proud of it. It's written by Charlotte Finn.
Yes.
That's the big thing.
Really,
I also have a Patreon at Ing for Art that I hope to be doing more with soon.
And that's the number 4.
Yes. Thank you.
Ing for Art. Yes. Yeah, right.
It's a pun or play on words.
As Terry Pratchett would say. Phil, did you have anything extra to
usual Apex Society, my webcomic. I'm starting to post stuff again because I finished. Yeah. I was off for a while because of headache issues, but I'm back.
Having seen the latest pages, there's a fight with Dracula, but not the Dracula you're thinking of.
A different Dracula. His name is Twilight. He's a Dracula. And yeah, I've been doing a lot of comics on my Patreon, actually. If there's been one of a month for the last for this year, and hopefully all year there will be new stuff. It's some of which is going to be seriously launching in a few more months, but right now you can read it all, so that's kind of cool if you want to check it out. So until next time, what's all this in?